It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And here we go, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all here. Captain Mike Ward, how are you?
Doing good, Sean. How about you, buddy?
Doing good. Doing good. And we are down to the waning days of deer season.
It comes fast and goes fast.
It does. And, you know, I was talking about this with my buddy the other night. I was heading back, did a weekday hunt, you know, finished up here at the radio station and did the old up and back.
Yeah.
That's when you know you'll drive as much time as you get to hunt, or more time than you actually get to sit in the stand. That's what it means to be the rut.
And we are in the middle of it right now.
That's right.
And at least where we're hunting at.
Well, and I want to tell you, we're going to talk about that because area-specific and site-specific is a conversation we've had so many times on this show where, you know, where you are in the Black Belt, you're seeing one thing. Where I am in western Washington County, I'm seeing something else. But I go to the southeastern corner of Washington County down on the river swamp, and I'm seeing yet something else.
Yeah.
You know, what the bucks are doing, what the does are doing. The bucks are always... In my opinion, they're ready.
The does are waiting on the doe.
So we'll talk about that.
At least we're going to get an expert opinion of that.
That's right. And this is and so we asked this on Facebook, too, earlier in the week, getting y'all's questions, and we'll try to get these answered as we have a discussion about the whitetail rut, because we're lucky to have Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator with Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, as our guest this morning on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Chris, thanks for being on.
You're welcome.
This is, yeah, tell us, like, first of all, before we even get into all this rut talk, deer program coordinator, what that's your job description. Talk about what a day in the life of a deer program coordinator for the state of Alabama looks like.
Well, it varies according to the time of year. This time of year, we're working hard on our CWD surveillance efforts. Other times of the year, we're sorting through the data that's been collected, you know, during the previous hunting seasons and any, you know, herd health checks we conduct. And so it's basically all things deer, and it never ends. So it's not like hunting season. It's 365 with deer in Alabama. So it's a good thing. I'm glad people are, you know, have that much passion about deer hunting and deer management that keeps us busy.
Yeah. You mentioned CWD. I just quickly wanted to talk about that because we've been focused on this, been talking about it for a year or so, and I know Director Sykes was on with us last year, maybe even early in last year. We started talking about those, the incidents of CWD over in the Mississippi Delta, over there along the river, and, you know, how it was over there, but we didn't know where else it was in Mississippi. And then I hear a series of stories about CWD showing up. Was it in Tennessee?
Yeah, they've got two kind of different spots in Mississippi, you know, since the initial finding over on the Mississippi River. They found a CWD positive deer in Pontotoc County, which is between Tupelo and Oxford, and then most recently they detected a positive up in Marshall County, which is up in the kind of northwest corner of Mississippi, up on it borders Tennessee, and so that prompted Tennessee into doing a little more focused surveillance on counties. There's three adjacent counties right there, and when they started looking, they found more than just a single deer. They found quite a hot spot, and Mississippi's finding kind of the same thing right up on the border. So I think the latest number on positives that Tennessee's found is I think it's bumping 30 or maybe even past 30, just in basically a month's time. So
wow,
and Mississippi's found 5 or 6 or something like that on their side of the state line right up in there. So yeah, it was one of those that when they found it and started really looking, they found quite a few. So they have a pretty high prevalence rate for an area where they're initially finding it.
So how do they find them?
It's been there a while.
So how do they find them, Chris?
Well, the ones, you know, the initial one they found over on the end of the Mississippi River, was a sick deer. You know, hunters saw it, had been seeing it for a few days, and actually, one of the hunters actually watched it die in the food plot where they'd been seeing him for about 3 days. So they called, and you know, reported a sick deer, and they sampled it, and it came back positive. The one in Pontotoc County was a deer that was acting strange. And a landowner called, reported it, and they dispatched it and tested it, and it came back positive. The one up in Marshall County that prompted the additional surveillance in Tennessee was a roadkill deer. So the three initial deer, at least in Mississippi, that in these three different locations were all either sick deer or roadkill deer, which from, you know, that's what you would expect. Those deer are more, if they're CWD positive, they're more susceptible to being hit by cars, being killed by hunters and things like that. So if a deer is, that's why we in Alabama, we're trying to get our hands on as many roadkill deer to sample as well as sick deer when people call and report them, in addition to the hunter harvested deer. But all three of those initial ones were either sick or roadkill deer, which are, you know, classic ones that you're gonna find it in them, and in places where, that have CWD, you're gonna find them in those deer at a little higher rate than you do just random sampling of hunter harvested deer.
I know y'all had talked about doing, I think it was in up in North Alabama, y'all were doing, was it last weekend or something like that, or maybe the weekend before, a sampling here for people who wanted to have the meat tested?
Well, it's, there's not a test that you can test the meat from deer to see if it has CWD. The tests have to be conducted on
the bone,
on other tissues.
Right,
what we collect is lymph nodes, but yeah, we did have a couple of the last two weekends. Two weekends ago, we were in Marion County at Hackleburg, and people could come by if they wanted to have their deer tested, just to know, and also help us with our surveillance efforts. So they could bring it by. And then last weekend, which was a bad weekend to be trying to sample it, I think it rained all day Saturday, and up in Lauderdale County at Waterloo. So they didn't have as good a participation as they did the weekend before in Marion, but it's something that's being offered. We also have some drop-off spots, some freezers set up at different locations in that part of the state, and we'll have those up and running in other parts of the state by next hunting season. But up there in the areas that are within 50 miles of those positives in Tennessee and Mississippi, we're making those drop-off points where people can bring their head and bag it and tag it with information for us to know who killed it and where it came from, and then they can they take a receipt off the bottom of the tag and drop it in the cooler or in the freezer, and our folks cook them up and get the samples and take them to the lab, and they'll be notified whenever the results come in on the deer they've killed. So we're trying to increase the availability of testing up there in that part of the world, especially in addition to our, you know, we're working with taxidermists and some processor too on collecting additional samples up there and in other parts of the state. You know, anywhere we can develop those partnerships with helping collect samples, we're doing it regardless of where it's at. So we really appreciate those folks working with us to get those, make getting those samples a little simpler. Sometimes it's pretty hard to just get samples from folks, as crazy as it sounds. But if you have somebody like that helping you, it makes it a little bit easier, because they have a lot of traffic coming in there with, you know, people that have deer, they've killed deer. And so if you can get the foot in the door there and have cooperative folks helping you out, it's really, really beneficial to us and our surveillance efforts.
We're listening to FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Our guest, Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for the state of Alabama, Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. Yeah, we're going to run to the break here, but one of the questions I would like to know, and we're going to, if y'all just joining us, we're going to talk rut here in a big way, but we want to talk a little bit about the update on CWD. You mentioned, you know, that hot spot there in northeast Mississippi. You mentioned the spot down near Vicksburg we had talked about last year. You know, the deer didn't walk up there in a year's time. I mean, the infected deer from down on the Mississippi River didn't walk up to northeast Mississippi in a year's time. So when we come back, Chris, I want you to talk a bit about that, and we'll kind of lay out how, you know, how this gets moved, CWD. And also, yeah, we get back, the man that knows when the deer in your neck of the woods are rutting and why, we're talking to him right now. So we're going to get into that. and continue our conversation right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. We'll be right back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you all here. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Remember, Facebook page, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. You got to put the outdoors on it because we've got the Facebook page for the entire radio station, but we also have one for this very show because they can't let us, we don't play nice with the rest of the Facebook page. So keep us over there.
We got to have our own.
That's right. And love to see your pictures as well. And a conversation here that is perfectly timed. Speaking of timing the rut and that discussion of what's going on in your neck of the woods. If y'all are you got deer chasing, you got deer cruising, you got them locked down. We'll get into that. You can send us a picture or discussion on our Facebook page. We're talking to Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. And Chris, right before we went to the break, and I do want to get into rut, but we're talking CWD with you, which is of prominent importance, keeping it out of our state. You mentioned the hot spot in northeast Mississippi for those CWD cases. And we talked about the earlier case down in Issaquena County in the Mississippi Delta. That deer, a CWD deer, positive deer, deer didn't walk up there, did it? I mean, it doesn't move that fast.
It doesn't move that fast. It's possible that especially those bucks and bucks tend to, they disperse out of their natal range where they were born. They can wander quite a few miles, and then when they start having issues associated with progressing CWD, then they're going to wander even further. So it's possible, but not likely. They're very likely that there's other deer in that area that have CWD, kind of like what they're finding up in northwest Mississippi and southwest Tennessee. But there's always the possibility that this is typically the route that CWD has been moved from one spot to a spot a whole lot further away, state to state or from one part of the state to another part of the state. This is movement of infected either live deer or carcasses are a prime candidate or prime way of transporting the disease to another area where it hasn't already been established. But and that's again, that's one of the things we're working as an agency to try to minimize the likelihood that chronic wasting disease will arrive in Alabama any quicker than it most likely will. It seems inevitable based on what everybody else is finding in other states, but we're doing what we can. One of the things is the carcass ban that we put in place, I guess, a couple of years ago. And this year it was, of course, expanded from just CWD positive states to expanded to include all states. So I hope hunters that are going out of state and hunting are aware of this, but they need to be. They have to have, if they go hunting at in Mississippi or Georgia or Montana and kill any deer species, be it white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, moose, caribou, anything that's in the deer family. They have to completely debone all the meat. They can bring back antlers that have been removed from the skull, skull plate and antlers, or they can bring back a caked out head or caked out skull. As long as the brain, all the brain matter, then they bring back the hide as well. But a lot of folks are doing the easiest way to handle that is to have your process up, where you're hunting and out of state and have it mounted if you're going to mount it like that. But if you do choose to bring it back, just be aware of what you can and can't bring back.
Yeah, that's for sure. We talked about it on the show. I was was in Colorado, killed a mule deer this year and had to skin out the head, which is new for an Alabama boy.
To get it mounted.
Yeah, to get it mounted. Because, you know, I said, we're out there with the Colorado guys. I said, usually we just cape them down to here and then take the rest in. But skin out the head, which and brought that very small piece of skull with the antlers on it and deboned all the meat. But that's not just, like you said, not just for somebody who's in Colorado. If somebody is in Mississippi, that's the deal too. And people can read more, I know, on OutdoorAlabama.com about those rules. And we've talked about it a bunch. I know we have commercials running here on the station about it as well. I do want to get into, you talked about the bucks moving out in the case you were talking about, out of their natal range as they're kicked out. But bucks also move a whole bunch this time of year, Chris. It is, love is in the air in the whitetail woods right now.
Right, yeah, they're checking every nook and cranny of their home range this time of year in a lot of the state. They're checking all those doe groups and looking for that first available doe or first willing and receptive doe, I guess you'd say. So they're covering some ground for the most part until those deer start coming into estrus, coming into heat, and then they'll start sticking close to the ones that they find that are get to that point. But right now in a lot of the state, where the peak of the rut, peak of breeding is for the end of January, even in the first week or so of February, this is probably the prime time to be hunting because of
Yeah, I want to get a breakdown. I have a little trouble hearing you on the phone, too. I don't know if it's just coming off the phone or the mouthpiece or whatever. We can still hear you, just it's not as clear as it was.
Okay.
That's better. And if you're joining us, Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for the state of Alabama, on with us. And we're talking rut. And you mentioned something, so I want to back up. I want to hit the rewind here.
Okay.
Be talking about we're close to prime time. But walk us through those stages, because you said, and we started talking about how bucks get out and move around, and you'll see a buck on a piece of, you know, somebody will come up to you and say, hey, you look at this picture of a buck. You're like, heck, I had that buck on camera back in our place in November. Now it's 10 miles down the road or 8 miles down the road. How does that work? When do, kind of walk us through a season there, when do those bucks start to expand their home range? And by how big of a percentage have you seen, like, what's normal and what's extraordinary?
Well, they're going to start getting out of their bachelor group. You know, they spend most of the time in the company of other bucks. But when it starts getting to this time of year, a few weeks before the breeding actually starts, they'll start cruising, covering more of their home range. They can start scraping more, rubbing, making all those scent posts scent marking and communicating with other deer and more so than they do in other parts of the year. And so it just, it depends. Some bucks, even during the rut, they don't move that much. They just don't have the large home range. But others, and it also depends on the habitat. You start talking about some of the areas with broken forest, blocks of forest scattered around. It's not, not just contiguous forest for thousands of acres. Deer in those more broken habitats will typically have a lot much larger home ranges. So they're typically the ones that you'll see miles from, like you were saying, you got a picture of him at point A this week, and next week he's 7 or 8 miles away at point B. But the likelihood of him coming back is pretty good unless he gets shot.
Yeah.
He's just, like I said, he's covering all parts of his home range. Another one, other areas they may only cover a couple thousand acres, even during the times of year when they move the most. So it varies according to the habitat and even according to the individual deer based on what researchers have found.
Tell me, what makes a doe come in heat? I mean, why is it different here than it is, in Mobile than it is, say, in central Alabama or north Alabama? What makes, everybody says, well, it's cold weather's coming, the doe's going to
get rough. Is it the
moon's
the
coming?
You've
got a full
day.
Moon, boy, the day after full moon, that's when they come in. I mean, what makes a doe come in heat?
Well, it's typically, and I guess most of the whitetail's range, it tends to be related to the photo period, the length of day, but when you start getting down into Alabama, they kind of throw that out of the window in a lot of places. And it's
seems to be that deer evolved to breed at times that was most beneficial to raising fawns. So they may be, because, let me back up, you know, most of the deer in southwest Alabama or southwest Alabama deer were used to restock most of the state. And so a lot of those, I'm sure a lot of folks have seen the map of conception dates available on our website, and you'll see a lot of spots of late January, early February breeding up in northeast Alabama in particular, mixed in with some New Year's breeding. And those deer apparently evolved to, it has to be in conjunction with the timing of flooding along those river drainages where they were, those populations were. And so it's really, really strange, because if you get up in the areas where the outside of that river drainage in places that, where the rut is earlier, and those areas that weren't reached out with those Clark County deer, you see rut dates similar to what you see in other places with native deer at that latitude. But you see the same thing in coastal barrier islands off the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. They rut very, very early. Probably in response to the timing of most of the hurricanes. The fawns are born and they're up pretty good size by the time hurricanes start coming ashore in August, September, and October. So it's those are kind of the off the wall.
Yeah, I mean, because you,
as opposed to what you see once you get up to say even into Tennessee and moving forward, it's basically November everywhere you go, except for those like along the coast. They'll breed and, you know, from what everybody that works over there and hunted over there around Charleston and other coastal areas over there, they're breeding as soon as their antlers are hard, basically. As soon as the velvet comes off, they're chasing toads. So,
yeah, they're hunting them then, too. They're hunting them in August, yeah. I think, right? They start off there.
Hey, yeah, with Alabama's late stuff, it appears, and again, I don't know how you would ever, you know, that positively conclude this, but it appears that that the areas that are late or that we use those stocking sources in Clark County primarily, it appears that those deer evolved to breed a little later, just to where they're the fawn rearing and the age of the fawns would be up to where they're able to better cope with flooding and whatnot.
And we get that it
historically flooded. So.
And we'll get back into this after the break, because I want to talk about that. I know, like, those weird, the Everglades, you would think, you know, when those deer would be breeding, and in South Louisiana, they have breeding dates that are, you would think that they'd be here with us or even later down there, but they're not. This is fascinating. We're going to talk about more about the rut here in Alabama, what brings it on. I also want to get into what the bucks are doing and why. You see, scrapes worked, and then all of a sudden, they're not working the scrapes? Does that tell you something? You know, what about all that? We're going to continue our conversation right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. You always got questions, you can drop us a line. Sean at FMTalk1065.com. Right, we're back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have y'all here. Remember, if you don't catch all the show on a given Saturday morning, you can check it out tonight. Show runs at 11 o'clock tonight, run again 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock tomorrow night, and always check out the podcast, which gets, our podcast numbers for the whole station have been crazy, how quickly they've built. This show is one of the lead dogs out there, I'll say that, in number of downloads.
Awesome.
You can go to the website, fmtalk1065.com, hit the podcast tab and download it there. Or you can subscribe over at iTunes or Stitcher, or go to Spotify, TuneIn Radio. Our podcasts are on all those places, and you can catch this show and share it. If you have want to talk about CWD with somebody in your hunting camp, or you want to talk about arguments you might have about timing of the rut, you can refer them to this episode. Say, well, y'all say this, but I was listening to the show the other day, and Chris said that y'all are wrong, and you put it off on him and not on you. Say, listen, the science says, Chris Cook says, y'all are wrong. Chris, I'm getting you in trouble, man.
That's
pretty much every day.
I sure appreciate you being on here. Deer Program Coordinator with Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, talking rut. And I do want to go kind of jumping around here, but when we went to the break, you were talking about some of the oddball, at least seemingly oddball rut dates out there. If you look through the Southeast, do we in the Southeast, if you take in the greater Southeast, have the biggest range of rut dates of any part of the country?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, in Alabama, basically, you know, with the data that we've collected over the years, we have deer breeding in October all the way into April, and maybe even later. We've collected a few deer that you could tell they were bred, and it was probably maybe even early May when they were bred. But by far and away the outliers. They're not the typical deer. Nearly all the deer that we've sampled over the years have been bred anywhere from 1st of December until mid-February, and the bulk of them being bred in January.
But, I mean, you compare that to some of the places, at least the way it seems, in the upper Midwest or even in the Northeast, it's like a 2-3 week window, and it's all done.
Yeah, yeah, they're consistent from one end of most states to the other. You know, their rut is the rut. No matter where you go in that state, and it's that way with us on, you know, different sites. Your rut date may be in February, but it's typically about a 3 week window that deer are being bred. And same way, if you're the peak of the rut is around New Year's, you're going to have about a 3 week period. It's not like deer are breeding from October through April from one end of the state to the other. It's location specific on a lot of that stuff, or most all those conception data.
I mean, we can ask it this way, though. I mean, I know you can't give us an exact because you don't know either property, but give us a guess here. So my partner here, Mike, hunts in
Marengo County
in the Black Belt, a well-managed area. When is his peak rut day? What is the high, when's the top of that bell curve for him? And then I hunt in western Washington County, right on the Mississippi line. When is the peak of my rut?
The stuff in Marengo County, and I particularly over in eastern Marengo County around Consul and Thomaston and all. From
that's where I hunt.
Collected it. Yeah, I know where you hunt.
Yeah.
Anyway. Anyway, yeah. It's typically the peak of breeding is kind of like the last week of January. And still some into February, but they'll start, the first deer start being bred here in the next week or so, or now. Well, you'll get the outlier on the early side, and then the peak of the bell curve is going to be around between the 25th of January, probably in the 1st of February, somewhere in there.
Okay, so that's for that? you in eastern. How about me? I'm in western Washington County. I am, if I drive to town, I go to state. I am west of Chatham, Alabama.
I can answer that. I don't think they rut there.
Based on the data we've gotten from that part of the world, it's your deer breeding. The peak is going to be somewhere probably in about the first week of February, and so they're going to be starting here. You know, probably about the 20th or so would be probably when you start seeing the first deer being bred, and then you'll have some bred, you know, a week or so probably after hunting season closes. So that's not that unusual on places in most southern parts of Alabama to have those the peak of the bell curve being that last week or first week of February.
What about
you get a little bit on each end of that, and unfortunately some of it's after hunting season, but typically the best hunting is actually, like in Mike's case, it's like from now until that peak of breeding, because there's fewer does out there ready to be bred, so bucks are moving and looking, and
right,
if they, as soon as they find that first one that's coming into estrus, every buck in the woods is after and same way on the tail end. That's when a lot of folks, they'll see that tail end of the breeding activity where there's just the unusual doe that was late coming into heat, and she's the only show in town, and everybody's after her. So that's, and when you see that in people's mind, it's, well, the rut's in full swing, but in actuality, it's at the tail end. And so it could be confusing looking at what you see in the woods and can compare that to the data we collect on our herd health checks, looking at actual age of fetuses and back date to conception date.
I know that was, of course, part of the process that moved that, you know, the end date to February 10th from where it had been at the end of January, which I know is appreciated by a lot of us down here in South Alabama. A question here, Chris, too, does, in that bell curve, right, so we got, you know, you have to start off, you go to the peak, and you come down. Have y'all seen anything that tells you the age of the doe or the age of the buck affects where they try to breed on that bell curve, or is it the same throughout the age classes?
Yeah, well, you know, I think y'all mentioned that at the beginning, bucks are always ready to go.
So, yeah, that's right.
You know, but you typically see the younger bucks are those first ones to start chasing does that are not quite ready to be bred, and you don't typically see the 3-4-plus-year-old bucks up on their feet chasing until it's, you know, it's actually time to go, and you'll see the 1.5, 2.5-year-old bucks kind of give you an idea, hey, they're probably getting close to things that are about to get right. But with the does, typically the year-and-a-half-old does will be, they may come in, especially in places where the rut is later, they're not, you know, they might be quite as physically mature as they are in some other places. So they're toward the end of that bell curve most of the time, but not all the time. You know, occasionally we'll have out of our sample, it may be a year and a half old doe that's one of the earliest does bred, but typically they're on the right side of that bell curve on conception dates. But they're all, you know, they're typically all within that same window that all the adult does are in as well.
I want to talk about. Yeah, Mike, you got a question?
No, not really. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going. Okay. Well, I was going to, because you talk about the young bucks chasing early, and so those 3-4-5-year-old bucks were once young bucks. So it's a learned behavior, right? I mean, it's when they were young, those were early chasers, and they just kind of learned to bide their time, or.
Yeah, it appears that way. You know, they're scraping and cruising, and they're picking up on what's going on in the woods scent wise and so they understand what, you know, that's how they communicate. So they know what's what, and it appears to be somewhat of a learned behavior as far as when to, all right, now it's time to start getting out and covering more ground, and because the time is here. But you know, all the bucks are going to get in on the breeding, and that, you know, that's another old wives' tale about only the mature bucks do the breeding, and it's just research project after research project documents that, you know, all the bucks get in on it. And this it's not one or two bucks doing all the breeding. So that's something people need to understand. So especially they start talking about, well, take this buck out or that buck out to improve the antler genetics on my property. It's like, well, that's fine, but, you know, he's got relatives all over the place that have those same genetics, and they're all getting in on the party, if you will.
Yeah, we all seem to forget too that the does are 50% of that formula. Yep. But
that's right, and you don't know which one is. You know, just because she's the biggest doe out there doesn't necessarily mean she produces the biggest fawns or maybe the bucks with the biggest or the best antler growth potential. It's a lot goes into that, not just the genetics, but also whether it's a single fawn or a twin, or even to the point of some does apparently have a little bit better quality milk based on, you know, where they're, you know, again, where they choose to live and feed and their diet affects all that as well. So there's a lot goes into it. So you can't just make too many assumptions based on what's on a buck's head about what their offspring's gonna look like.
Chris, I had a friend of mine tell me the other day, and I couldn't debate him on it because I didn't know the answer to it. He told me that there could be two or three different bucks breed a doe, and that doe could have a baby from each one of them. Is that right?
Yeah, they have shown that. Wow. Dr. Randy DeYoung, he first was able to document that in some pen studies, and he was
I think when he was working on his PhD at Mississippi State, but he's also now documented in some wild populations as well. So, you know, a doe may have twins that, were sired by two different bucks. So it's that just muddies the water even further when you start talking about trying to manage genetics, which is, you know, for the overwhelming majority of folks, that's the last thing they need to be concerned about when you're talking about managing for quality deer, healthy deer population.
Okay, I want to just pick your brain having you on here. Heck with managing. I want to manage to kill one. So help educate me here on this. When we see scrape activity, like, and it'll be funny on that, you know, the difference between Mike's where he's hunting the peak rut and mine, our scrape activity will line up too with that. You know, when you see active scrapes versus when you see that day that they quit working the scrapes, and we as hunters say that means they're chasing. They're on now. Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, typically the scraping activity is going to peak, you know, a couple of weeks before the does actually start coming into heat. So when you have that flurry of scraping activity and then it all of a sudden stops, then that's a pretty good indication that the does are coming into heat and breeding's going on. So that is a pretty good clue.
All right.
And a lot of times, you know, you won't, with the weather conditions and hunter hunting pressure and things like that, you just may not see the deer moving at those times of the year, even though the breeding's going on and they should be, you know, that's most visible. Other things can figure in there, and we see that a lot of times on properties where we've collected that kind of data, conception date data, multiple years. You talk to the folks that hunt on those properties and they tell you that, well, the rut was like 2 weeks later this year, or we just didn't even have a rut. Look at the data, and it's the same as it is every year, basically, except it might vary a week as far as the peak. So the, you know, warm, rainy weather just, you know, doesn't do a whole lot for deer movement. It's putting a lot of hunt pressure on a property also doesn't do a lot to help daytime movement of deer either.
All right, we're running the break and come right back. More of this discussion, because I'm going to bring up the one of the more hotly debated subjects out there too, about the rut lockdown. And what is lockdown a thing? How does it work if it is? We're talking to Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, and we're coming right back on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you here, and great to have our guest, Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, on as we ask him everything rut.
Yeah, we had a whole nother show during the break.
That's right, we sure did. Poor Chris. You said you're used to it, though, all these questions. That's a good thing, I guess, that people are engaged in whitetails in Alabama.
Yeah, it keeps you on your toes, because you never know what you're going to get asked when you get around a group of deer hunters.
That's right. We got all kind of questions like the one I lobbed at you before before going to the break. But this is one that I've heard, we've talked about. We talked about on the show. I've talked about at the hunting camp. Lord knows you go to social media and hear the debates back and forth. Talking about the rut and talking about lockdown. Chris, is there such a thing as a lockdown with a buck?
Well, with the way that the deer, the bucks are looking for does. Once they find the doe that is right about, she's, you know, within a day of coming into heat or whatever, he's not going to leave her. And if he can get her off by himself, then, you know, that's even better. But if you're on a property with a well balanced buck doe ratio, then the likelihood of him being able to keep one to himself is pretty slim. So they're going to be up and moving, just staying away from other bucks, but or trying to. Unfortunately, they don't. It doesn't usually work out, but yeah, it definitely could be a. They're gonna hole up with the doe and try to keep her to themselves. And so when you get into that peak, when the majority of does are in heat, then typically you will see a decline in buck movement, because they're not having to seek out a doe. There's plenty of targets out there, and when they find one, they're staying with it.
Do those does change their behavior at all, though? I mean, it, you know, my idea was always towards the end of the season, you know, we go get on big pastures or even in the green fields because that, you know, we're figuring, well, that doe's going to lead him right into the patch.
Yeah, they typically, when they're actually ready to be bred, they don't move that much unless they're getting pressured by a buck. You know, they have increased activity, but it's not in a big area. They're kind of, I guess you'd say, antsy and know that it's time to be bred, and so they're probably still eat and whatnot, but they're not going to be in their normal movement routine during that just small window, 2 or 3 days, when they're coming into heat and actually in heat.
Chris, do the does go to the bucks when they start getting in heat? Do they start looking for bucks? Do they go to the buck scrapes looking?
In whitetails, it's definitely the bucks are seeking them, but the does, when she gets ready, she becomes receptive. You know, most of the time, when you're seeing chasing, this deer that typically they're not really ready to be bred, so they're not receptive, and so they're running from deer, and bucks are, they can sense they're close, so they're going to continue to chase. But when she gets ready to breed, she's going to be a lot more willing to stand still for them. So the bucks typically search them out, but then the does, you know, once they get to that point, they become receptive, not necessarily seeking out the bucks, but they don't run from them. You know, like in other species, they will tend to, the does tend to seek out the bucks, like in mule deer and elk. They'll tend to go to them and more of a doe group or harem, if you will, with the bucks rather than the individual love connection with whitetails.
Well, I mean, and we can look at it maybe overly simplistic, but the component of chasing for white-tailed deer, I think, I mean, you look at it, and now you've pointed out that they can be bred by multiple bucks, but it makes me think, well, you know, only the healthiest deer are breeding, the one that can, you know, chase the longest, but maybe that's just not directly related to who they breed with.
I mean, it might be the dumb ones that are exerting all that energy chasing. The smart ones are waiting around, all right, she's not ready. And when she gets ready, he moves in, and he's not exhausted, and he's able to take care of business. So you don't know which one's smarter or what, but it seems like the ones that, whether it's a learned behavior or whatnot, they understand, hey, there's no need to exert all that energy chasing a doe that's not willing to stand still because she's not something. You know, it's not time, but I don't know about that one. I would think the one that sits back and relaxes and takes it as he when it gets ready, he might be the smarter one.
The farmer's always talking about the old bull and the young bull. Yeah. Yeah. Look down there at the group of cows.
We'll just...
what about, you mentioned estrus. How long does a doe, white-tailed doe in Alabama, stay in estrus?
They're actually only in heat and just, you know, can be bred in about, I think it's about 36 hours or so, you know, day and a half, 2 days. Of course, she'll be getting close, you know, a little bit in beforehand. So that's when the bucks are really going to stick with her. And then once she actually is in heat, can be bred, they're not going to leave her. So, and then they'll stay with her for just a little bit. So once a buck finds one that's about to come in, he may be with her for 3 or 4 days, just depending on how, you know, at what point in that window he actually comes across her and picks up on her scent.
You know, how many?
She's only in, can be, you know, she only is ready to be bred for a little less than 2 days, typically, is the estrus cycle.
How many does typically does a buck in a while breed, typically?
Yes, it's very few, you know, unless it's a unique situation where there's a, you know, really skewed buck to doe ratio, then you know, he'll a buck will work himself to death. But in a typical situation that's, you know, got a reasonable buck to doe ratio, say it's two does for every buck, then the likelihood of a buck breeding more, you know, four, maybe five does in a typical breeding season is rare. You know, most of them's going to breed a little less than that. And like I said earlier, you know, every buck gets in on it when he can, even a year and a half old deer, because there's all, you know, they can't be, the mature bucks can't be everywhere all the time. So, So when they're, and again, if a doe has several bucks around her when she actually comes in to heat, she's likely to stand for several of them, and you know, they've been able to show that she can have fawns that are sired by two different bucks. So she's, you know, just because the one buck bred this time and another one bred the next time, it doesn't mean that the first one that bred her sires both the fawns. It could be both of them.
How about that?
Both bucks could have a fawn.
We're about to run out of time, but I do want to get just a minute here left, give you a chance to talk about game check. I mean, it's the law, but why is it important for someone that has your job?
Yeah, game check was put in place to help us get more data, or better data, on where deer are being killed and when they're being killed. And as everybody that's interested in deer management knows, on their property, they know how important it is to collect data on the property, and so it's, you know, just should make sense that it's equally as important to try to collect that data on a larger scale, regional and statewide. So knowing those harvest rates and knowing how our season structure and bag limits and everything else associated with the season is impacting the harvest is important. And by having game check, it gives us that tool to track that info, track that data. It's really easy to do. We have the app, and you can report it online through your phone browser at home on your computer. But it's really easy to report what you harvest, and we really, like I said, it really is important in the future management of deer in Alabama.
Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator with the State of Alabama, thank you for your time. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. Anytime.
All right. Yeah, we'll do it more and get you back on the show soon. We got to get out of here. Prep Sports Report on the way next.